So I'm delighted that Les Parsons has been able to squeeze us in before he takes off to Russia. And he is coaching both the Canadian as well as the British ski teams. Can't imagine how any Englishman can ski, but apparently they can. And he's doing this because, well, one might assume because he wants twice the chance at winning. But I don't think that's the case. I think it's because he absolutely adores and loves the kind of work that he does. Sport and religion are such an intimate part of each other. There is a sense in which a lot of athletics is really a form of religious commitment. The word in English, athletics, has its roots, of course, in the Greek word ascesis, which is what we call monks. Ascetics is the same root. Why? Because you must discipline your body, discipline your mind, discipline your time, discipline your space around some sense of what is going to be ultimate for you. So it is marvelous to have Les here. He was a student here at Augustana, studied with, spent time with the Gipper, I guess.
And Doc.
And then was a cross-country runner, reminding me of that famous book from the 60s, Are You Running With Me, Jesus?, written in Chicago. And then got talked into joining the ski team and came within a hair's breadth of missing the Olympics himself. So thank you, Les. We look forward to your leading us in a reflection here.
I'll start by the topic today is servant leader, and so standing here right now, I think, gee whiz, I'm one of the least qualified people to talk about that, because some of you have already got 50 or 60, maybe 70 years of experience in servant leadership, and I'm just getting my feet wet at it some days. I'm not really the expert on servant leadership or servant leading in general, so it's... That's a challenge for me to stand here and talk, because I'm talking to the choir who's got the song sheet already figured out, and I'm still trying to get through the first verse. So that's one of my introductory comments. Having said that, I'll talk a bit later about servant leaders in my life. And I often thought at one time it was people that were older than myself, but having Rochelle here and Allie and Caitlin and Carlina, these are great servant leaders that are student leaders here at Augustana. So I've sort of flipped it around and thinking it's not just always the elderly who are servant leaders, but everybody. So I'm glad to see some students here. The other part I struggle with servant leadership is hypocrisy, because those two words don't even get together and they don't even make sense. Servant and leader are almost contrasting words sometimes. And in my own life, I feel like I know I'm a hypocrite, because I get a lot of recognition for being a leader, as a coach, as a politician, as an environmentalist, and I'm labeled all the time as a leader, and that's not what I want. I'd rather serve and not get recognition for it, because I'm convinced that if we get recognition from other people, that our motivation is the wrong motivation. Our motivation is to make a difference in people's lives and serve. So I am a hypocrite, or as David put it, blasphemy. So certainly take in context what comes out of my mouth. For you students and for all of us, I really encourage people to consider ourselves as a big melting pot. So I've been fortunate in my life, and I'll share that in a few minutes, I have this great big pot in front of me, and I've stolen throughout my whole life all the leadership qualities of people that I've really admired and put them in my pot and stirred them around and around and around. And every month or every year, or maybe once, maybe twice in 1 week, then not for a couple years, I'll find some other quality of some other leader that I really like, and I throw that into my pot of leadership development. And that pot's never full. And if it overflows, that'd be great, but I would consider my pot probably half full, or if I'm a pessimist, half empty, and I've still got a lot of things to throw into that pot to learn. So that's my view of it, and it's changing, it's dynamic. So my understanding of servant leadership is changing as I experience new things in life and as I go along. Rather than talk about my leadership experience, I want to highlight the leaders in my lives that have made a huge difference, starting with my mom,
who is one of the most caring Social Gospel United Church women that I know. She's just the traditional, good old-fashioned United Church women, this thing from the Fairview Community Center, then the Lacombe United Church. And she has always been this caring person who practices the Social Gospel. And I can't emphasize enough the nurturing and caring and love that we had in our family with my brother, two brothers and my sister and I, and all my cousins, and we all lived along the same country road, about 100 of us, because my mom's got 11 brothers and sisters, and dad 6, sort of like a Scottish Hutterite colony. So my mom was kind of the Social Gospel of that Hutterite colony. She's still to this day quite active with United Church Women. My dad is extremely community-oriented and has gone nuts in the Lacombe and Central Alberta region, first as a farmer, then with United Farmers of Alberta, then with Peter Lougheed and the Old Boys Club, and then he got involved with out of farming and into more agricultural development, and then into Parsons Holiday Tours. He drives a bus around full of senior citizens, and he's just a hooked Lions Club, all these different service clubs. He can't stop moving, and he's set the tone for me for community action. From there, I don't remember much until I was about 5 years old. We were unplugging the swather, and I got my thumb amputated in the swather. And I'll make the story short, but they put the thumb back on. It doesn't work, and it's great. But we went to Lacombe. They were going to chuck it out. Went to Red Deer. They put it on. It would fall off. So I remember going in the station wagon with my mom crying, my dad driving it. Back then, it was miles an hour, about 100. The wheels wobbling in this old Parisian station wagon. Got to U of A Hospital, and the doctor did this first reattachment of an appendage. It was 1965. And it was quite successful. Dr. Hitchin. Anybody here a nurse who's worked with Dr. Hitchin? Okay, yep. So you know Dr. Hitchin.
Oh, yes.
His nickname was Bitchin' Hitchin. And this was a scary man. He hollered at me, "Why did you put your hand in the swather?" I was 4 years old. I was just unplugging it. Back then, you left machines running. That's not the story. The story is there was a nurse at that U of A hospital who was like an angel. And I don't remember her name. I just remember her face. And she was an incredible servant leader, coming in, telling me stories that I was going to be okay. I was terrified. I was scared. I was too young to even know where I was at. And yet this nurse was probably the first servant leader in my life outside of my own family that really I can still see to this day, who made me sleep, who made me stop crying, who made me laugh, and those kinds of things. And I don't know what her name was. I don't know. Was it you, Marjorie? No, it was somebody, and that's someone who I'll never know. She's just a special person in my life that made a big difference. From there, I had to then go into piano lessons to get this thumb to work because it doesn't bend. So I had a lady called Muriel Nalichin, who was a really good piano teacher. No one's ever heard of her before. She's not famous, but she got me playing the piano, and then we had these big recitals, and we'd get up in front of everybody in Lacombe and play these things. And she was never on the stage. She wouldn't even introduce us. She'd have one of the parents introduce us. And from that group, we have Anna Marie Kaufman, one of the world's top opera singers all over the world that I used to party with in high school. We've got all these different yahoos from that particular group who've pursued music at a very high level. And no one will ever know what Muriel Nalichin did for us. We had a fellow called Earl Johnson from the West Lacombe 4-H Beef Club. He couldn't put a sentence together in front of us. He would mumble and stumble through stuff, and his wife Betty would do all this baking for us. We'd have these 4-H meetings, and it was chaos. And from that particular group, we all went on to do some pretty neat things all over the world, including public speaking. He made his public speaking, told us how good we were at it, and keep going. But he couldn't put a sentence together himself. He was a cowboy, like you'd see in some Western magazine, big belt buckle about, you know, this skinny, and just he had a real funny drawl. But Earl and Betty Johnson were super in my life as people that will never probably recognize for all they did for that part of the province for 4-H, for the beef movement there. We had a fellow called Dave Rogers. He was our Sunday school teacher at Lacombe, the Lacombe St. Andrews United Church, and Dave Rogers was a phenomenal man. All the parents went to the sanctuary, and it was chaos over in the Christian Education Auditorium. It was just mayhem, and there'd be about 100 or 200 of us, and he would do it solo. He would take on this crowd. He'd have us singing. He'd be teaching us. He entertained us. He was phenomenal. He died of cancer when I was about 10 years old, and that was the end of church for our whole family. Then my brothers and I and my sister, we revolted because the next Sunday school teacher didn't quite match up to Dave Andrews. And he was a real, real servant of people, a servant of God, and he just practiced God's love in a real way. So he was super in my development as seeing a servant leader go. From there, in high school, we had a fellow called Mr. Lutz, Alan Lutz, and he was a running coach. And he got me started running, and I didn't know really much about running except for I chased cattle all over the farm. And he took me from a cattle chaser to a champion cross-country runner. Just kept telling me, you can do it. You can run fast. And I said, well, I don't know. You know, I don't even like it. It hurts my lungs, and I'm tired. Well, you can run faster, sprint, and this and that. So he was a really instrumental person in my life in terms of athletics for getting me started in this sports thing. Then I went to the U of A. And U of A was great. We had a great professor there called Dr. Harvey Scott. He's the past president now of the Green Party of Canada, and a real super humble professor. You go into his office, and you were the central focus. He didn't care about his books. He didn't care about anything else but you and how to meet our needs. And I always tell people that Harvey is the most Christian, non-Christian I've ever met. He refuses to say that he believes in God, but he said his mom's an old United Church lady, Presbyterian lady from down eastern Canada somewhere. She just kicked the bucket at 100 and some years of age. But he would sort of always say, oh, no, I'm not religious at all. But I would say, if you gave a Martian a Bible and say, go find somebody, they go straight to Harvey Scott. This guy just was the gospel. He really cared and loved for people like nobody I've ever met. That was my experience at U of A. I came to the Camrose Lutheran College in 81 and took the spring course. Oh, by the way, Harvey's wife, Evelyn, is still super active. So is Harvey. He's working on the oil sands, the water contamination of the Athabasca River. And his wife, Evelyn, is working on forestry and deforestation in that whole region of northern Alberta, from Lac La Biche up to Fort McMurray. So Evelyn herself is even a less well-known but powerful leader with the NDP and the Greens and the Liberals and the Social Democrats. She's a phenomenal lady. So then I came over to Augustana, and I had time to spend a spring course with Doc and Lois Larson and Dorothy and Gary Gibson. And that was transformative in my understanding of leadership, because Gibber and Doc basically said, you ignoramus. Because at the point when I came here, I wanted to be the first guy to the top of the mountain, the first guy to paddle through the whitewater, the first person to bag every peak and this and that. I didn't really care about other people. And they introduced me to this whole idea of servant leadership, others before self. And what Lois and Doc and Dorothy and Gary have done over the years in transforming, thousands of outdoor leaders in their program is unrecognized. I don't think people realize around Canada, but I look at my peers from that group and the people who are before me and after me, and it's pretty powerful to this day with Morton and his impact on the students here. And it's we've got a phenomenal legacy. Neil Hartling is one of our graduates. He now runs Canada's largest river expedition company, and him and his wife Judy, again, are super servant leaders, are the owners of the company, but they put the guides before themselves. They run this operation through Nunavut, Alaska, Northwest Territories, and Yukon, all over the wilderness areas, and they've empowered guides and supported us as river guides to get out there and do these really high-risk wilderness adventures. So those are some key people that have really given me some direction. I've been involved a bit in politics. I've worked closely with Don Mazankowski. Him and his wife, Lorraine, are phenomenal people. Lorraine is a super articulate person that understands how politics really works, whereas Don sort of got stuck in the spotlight. Lorraine just seemed to be able to figure things out and balance things out in a pretty good way. So they were quite influential in my political endeavors, and they kicked me into getting involved in federal politics. And it's for Don and Lorraine that I blame now. I'm 0-7 federally in federal elections, and pretty soon headed for 0-8 possibly, but that's their role. Another one is Michelle Dionne, the wife of Jean Charest, is probably one of the smartest politicians I know beyond Maureen McTeer, I'll talk about in a minute. But Michelle Dionne is the person who organized what was left of the Conservative Party, and they went from 202 seats down to 2 seats. She really cared about people, and she did everything she could to support all of us when we took a whomping and encourage us all to keep on going. And she's a very strong leader right now in Quebec, and I would hope that someday Sheree will step back and let Michelle lead, but she's too humble to. Maureen McTeer and Joel Clark are good friends of mine. I've worked closely with them. And again, Maureen is super, super connected to people and super connected to what's going on in the real world. She understands the trenches and the frontline reality of poverty, of people who are suffering. She's a smart cookie. And Joe does pretty good for himself as well. So I've had time to spend with these politicians. And that's sort of not leadership, I guess, because those are people you would think at the top of the pyramid. And servant leadership, we've got to flip it upside down where the leaders at the bottom, servant leaders at the bottom, everybody's ahead of themselves. But they're people who are influential, who have that real flavor of servant leadership about them, that I can see their real others before self attitude. I've been able to meet Bill Cosby a couple times. Him and his wife Camille are phenomenal people, just really super caring. Bill's one of my heroes. We're allowed to have heroes in life. I like Bill because he never gets into swearing and keeps the comedy really positive and upfront and family-based, and so he's a big fan. I'm a big fan of his. But his wife Camille, who does all this stuff around Bill, is a support person. So Bill's where he is today because of Camille Cosby. No one's ever heard of the lady, but she's one of these people that does stuff all the time for people. I've traveled lots around the world and have encountered phenomenal people in every continent. I've been to 40-some countries, and the people are wonderful. And there's millions and millions of servant leaders out there. And I met them through the Islamic community, through the Hindu community, the Buddhist, Shamanism, Confucianism, Judaism. There's great leaders in all those religions, and even non-spiritual leaders, people that aren't religious, that are doing great things that'll never be recognized. And probably for me, the most stuck in memory would be working for Mother Teresa. I worked for her in a few places, just volunteered, not worked, alongside the Sisters of Charity, the Missionaries of Charity. There's brothers and sisters, mostly sisters, and a few brothers. And beneath Mother Teresa's statue, there's a little quote from St. Francis or somebody that says, "Preach your gospel at all times, and only if you have to use words." Preach your gospel at all times, and only if you have to use words. So I got to work with in Kaligat, which is the original place she had. That's where they gather people from around Calcutta, and they bring them to die with dignity. They give them a little sort of white army cot and some white sheets and some white clothing. And there's a side of the building for the women, a side of the building for men. And our job was to ease their suffering as they pass on. Some of them would come and get better and go back out and live for 2 years and come back for a few weeks and go out. But some of them would come and die. And most of them end up dying there. And her thought was they would die with dignity, and they would be loved as they die. So my first day there, I was in shock because I've never really seen people that skinny and emaciated or whatever, you know, you can envision from the concentration camps in Poland and Germany. But it was bad. So I said, so what do I do? Like, I'm standing there with my hands in my pocket because I don't really want to get involved, but I'm supposed to get involved. And they said, oh, just care for these people. And, you know, you rub their back and hum and hold their hand. And if they cry, you can hug them. And so when I'm a cowboy from Central Alberta, that's not really my common nature to go hug strangers I don't know, but who I don't understand. They speak Bengali or Hindi in different languages. Very few, hardly anything spoke English at all. So I thought, okay, I'll try that. So I tried my best, and then the first guy I go to hug, he has this explosive eruption of diarrhea and vomit at the same time, and I'm like 25 feet back, oh no, my gosh. So then the nun says, okay, you can clean him up. And how do you clean up? I said, how do you do this? Like, ugh. Like, what? I could hardly change my nieces and nephews' diapers. This was a big disaster. There was fluids all over the guy. And she goes, oh, it doesn't matter how, just do it with the smile. And I said, what limb to move first, or how do I start? She goes, it doesn't matter, just do it with love and the smile. So, you know, an hour later, I get this guy cleaned up, over an hour, and then he craps and vomits again. I start all over again, and I'm ready to vomit myself, and it was hard. So that was my uncomfort, beyond my comfort zone. And the same thing happened. I got to work in an orphanage. I got to work with lepers. I got to work with prostitutes. They have quite a few programs in Calcutta. They have 8 different programs, and they were all humbling. And you know what sealed the deal for me on how impressive these people are. So when I was in Cairo, they asked us to sit in rocking chairs, and it was an orphanage where they collected newborns every day from all over Cairo, and it's a big place of 10 million something like that. The Coptics, I spent time with them. They're great folks. And so they just put me in a rocking chair and gave me babies for human contact. You put the head in your elbow and their feet here and just rock them. And once they have human contact, they go to sleep and they replace them with another one. Then keep bringing crying babies and you just sit there and rock. And, you know, the first little bit I didn't mind. And I was exhausted after an hour and completely drained at the end of the day. And it was a long few weeks working there. And it was just to give them this contact. And what blew me away was once in a while these babies would die. None died in my arms, fortunately, but they would die. So the nuns would gather around and they'd sing these beautiful hymns and wrap these babies up in cloth and take them away. And I'm just bawling because I might have held that kid the day before. And they bring in a new baby. And the spirit of joy and the spirit of love in these sisters and brothers' eyes, I can never explain. Same thing at Kaligat in Calcutta. In this horrendous human suffering thing, their ability to walk around and smile and joke and laugh and even make, you know, bring some joy to a real dire situation was beyond human comprehension. I just can't, I'm jealous of them because they've got a change of clothing and a small little room. And we'd meet every morning in the chapel to sing these beautiful hymns. You'd have maybe, I would say, 1,000 sisters and a few brothers meet upstairs around 5 o'clock. Then they'd go all over the city like that. And they had bananas and tea and old bread. That was their meal. And then off they'd go. And I was super jealous, thinking, these are servant leaders. And there was a new one called Sister Nirvella who took over from Mother Teresa. But we're never going to hear of her or all these sisters and brothers that are serving that will never, ever be known. Like, these are people that are serving others and serving God beyond the call of duty. And we're never going to hear of them. They're just out there. And that, to me, is so humbling. If there's one thing when I think of social or servant leadership, it is humility. How humble these people were. They aren't writing books. They aren't on TV. They'll never be known. And that's just in Calcutta. It's happening all over the world. They do this. And then I've realized that it's not just the sisters and brothers, but it's people all over the world that are doing things out of the spotlight, out of recognition of other people. And that's why I'm so self-critical of my hypocrisy, is that I am up in front and leading, and I know that these people are working way harder, dealing with a much harsher reality, dealing with a much more difficult situation than I'll ever deal with. It just, I just know that. And that's stuck in my mind forever, the image of these beautiful eyes of these beautiful people that looked at me and they probably felt sorry for me. I know they did, because here I was a white, you know, a white millionaire, white guy, you know, from Canada, from their perspective, because these little nuns are from all over the Indian subcontinent, and they're just working and serving with this big joy. And so that's sort of defined for me servant leadership at its rawest. The fellow who opened me up for cancer, Dr. Marois, in Quebec City, he opened me up and pulled out my whole stomach and half my liver because I had this big sort of a grapefruit cantaloupe-sized cancer tumor. A super person. And he came in and told me, introduced himself, told me what he was going to do. And I said, okay, well, whatever. And then afterwards he woke me up and said, well, I had to cut out more than I thought I would, but you're good to go. And he just disappeared. But this guy was great. And then all the nurses kept telling me what a great, wonderful person he was. He'd come back and visit me every day for a few minutes and hold my hand and ask how I was and rub my hand and said, good, 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 good. And he'd take off again. No one's ever heard of Dr. Marois, and he's just out there hammering away. He is the nurse's favorite because he really loves his patients and loves other people. And the nurses say in surgery, he's asking them how they're doing and what's going on. And he really cares about people in a way that is beyond my understanding. I've had a chance to start doing some work in Maskwacis or Hobima, and it's there's some really incredible people there. I don't understand the situation in Hobima. It breaks my heart. I find it quite depressing or overwhelming, or I can't deal with it. I'm shocked at what's happening right now in Hobima and across our whole country. I've been through the Arctic of Canada with the Inuit and the Dene, and it's a mess. And the strength of some of the people that I've met there and the servitude that they have to meet the needs of their people is incredible. We hear the bad news, but the good news is there's some phenomenal people there that are helping them help themselves. And I'm just trying to figure out how I can learn from them and what role I might be able to fulfill as a coach to make a wee bit of a difference in Hobima at some point. But it's it's a tough go, but boy, there's some people there that, again, will never be recognized. Here in Camrose, I'm convinced, for the people that I recognize here and lots more beyond here, that this community is full of servant leaders. I have no doubt that people are doing incredible things all over the place. I see maybe 1%. If you look at an iceberg, you might see 3 to 5% or maybe 10% of the ice on the surface. But beneath the surface in Camrose, I know there are thousands of people doing thousands of acts every day that will go unrecognized and never noticed. And that's the way maybe God wants it, or maybe that's the way it's supposed to be. You know, I hope and pray that's the way it's supposed to be. Because there's too much confusion in today's world of people wanting recognition, of people leading. And I don't know how we're ever going to turn that around. In Forbes magazine last year, there's a real big question about why isn't servant leadership more prevalent? Why is it not taking over in our society? And they just came down to the bottom line that people are too self-serving. Rather than serving others, people end up being self-serving. They might go into things with the intention of serving others, but then they end up being self-serving. They end up benefiting themselves somehow. And the temptation in the worldly way of things, in the pursuit of the world, is to do with money and power and sex and whatever military control or economic or land control, whatever it is. And that seems to take away from real service of others before self. And that's a hard one to swallow. So that was in Forbes magazine last year, and it's worth looking at. I don't know how to define servant leadership. The one thing I do know is those two words are a contrast. They're almost like the two extremes, servant and leader. In terms of how a world defines them both, it's an upside down, backwards thing. I guess one thing that I've done more and more of myself, first of all, and others, is question, why do I do what I do? Or why do other people do what they do? And that's just a simple question I ask myself. When I see somebody doing something, when I'm watching the news, or see someone in the community, or see anything, I'll often wonder, why do they do what they do? What's their motive for it? And that's just a simple question that is very hard to answer. And I keep asking that of myself more than anybody else, because it's not mine to judge why people do what they do. All I can judge is myself, or challenge myself to say, Les, why are you doing that? What's your reason? What's your motive? And that's a tough question to answer sometimes as we go along. I can't justify going to Sochi. Next week, I'm going to take a piece of wax this big, worth about $2,000, and put on some skis so someone can race around on it for about 15 minutes or 30 minutes or maybe an hour and a half. You can't justify that in today's world. Not when there's a war just south of Sochi in Syria, 1,000 kilometers away, or, you know, 3,000 kilometers away, the Sahel region with all the famine and drought they've had, or the Central African Republic, or South Sudan, and all the conflicts in the world, all of Asia, all of Africa, Obima. You know, how do you justify this kind of stuff? You can't. I just can't justify to myself a piece of wax for someone to run around in some idyllic world on a pair of skis and slide around and finish 10 feet from where they started. They didn't even get anywhere. So it's hard to justify. You can Google Robert Greenleaf, and he's probably written a book on servant leadership. He was in 1970, he wrote this book called The Servant Leader, and it's gone on from there. He defines servant leadership in really real clear terms of others before self and caring. And some of the key words he had were humility, acceptance, empathy, listening, understanding, caring, sharing. Those are the key words that he emphasized a lot in his definition of servant leadership. And I like what he wrote. He's not written it from a biblical perspective. He just wrote it as a human being who really cares about other people. And so that's my definition of servant leadership is his definition of servant leadership. But before we define it a bit more, I'd like you to go around and just holler out in any particular order who has been the most inspirational servant leader in your life. Because that would help us define what a servant leader is. If we can just throw some names out of any, it could be a celebrity, a no-name, it could be anybody you can think of on this planet who's here before us or after us, but who would you holler out as the most significant servant leader that you've encountered? Because this will give me a better idea of how to define it. Because you are leaders, and I'm servant leaders, and I want to know what sticks out in your mind. So in any particular order, just holler out that person and maybe a quick sentence of why.
Nelson Mandela.
One of Nelson's quotes. I hope this thing works still once in a while. I'm not very high-tech, by the way. I can barely scroll. I don't know how to use a Blueberry or a Sony Walkman or anything like that at all.
The Blueberry.
Blueberries or blackberries. Strawberries. Nelson Mandela said this: it is better to lead from behind and put others in front, especially when you celebrate victory, when things occur. You take the front line when there is danger. Then people will appreciate your leadership. So, thanks. That's a good one. Any others? There's lots, yeah?
Dietmar
Mundell. Yeah.
Yeah. Humble.
Humble?
Yeah. And a real leader deep-hearted servant.
Yeah. In my year and a bit here, the impact he's had on students has been out, and the community is unbelievable. And that's just one year. So, yeah.
Can I ask something?
Sure.
It seems to me you're saying two things, and I'm really interested that you. It's very interesting that you brought up Mr. Klein. One thing I hear you saying is that in a world where politicians at least are, I mean, I think there are many really remarkable politicians, but they are coached, and there's a kind of political public culture which turns them all into propagandists. That is, they have to stay on point, and the point is defined by others. In that kind of a world, Mr. Klein was unique. He didn't do that. He was willing to say whatever he meant. So in that sense, servant leader is somebody who's straightforward. Is that part of
probably
your point?
Probably that's maybe on a better way than straightforward, or maybe honest.
Yeah.
But when I say that, I mean, I certainly agree with what he was trying to accomplish, but he did.
Would you say the same thing about Mr. Trudeau? I mean, Mr. Trudeau struck me as being rather similar in that way, although cut from slightly different cloth.
Yeah. Yeah.
But straightforward.
Yeah.
If I don't understand it, I'm going to tell you.
Yeah. Yeah.
Interesting.
And you love him or hate him, right?
I argued with Ralph Lotz. He would turn that beat red because I was on the writing association for Steve West, his hatchet man at the time. And but Colleen and him didn't die millionaires. You know, or she's still kicking, but you know, he didn't die a multimillionaire. He didn't do a lot to line his own pockets. I've worked lots with Preston Manning. We've had great fights but again, stuck to what it wasn't populist. I worked with Elizabeth May. She's not populist. People don't like her. And, you know, we're getting 5-10% of the vote, but we're sticking to what we think is the honest, best-term solution for the long-term future of the planet and Canada. But it's not a popularity contest because we're getting hammered. So it's, yeah. I've argued with Maz Lotz about is politics. He was Minister of Finance and Deputy Prime Minister. He ran the country while Mulroney was out making mistakes all over the planet. And so he kept telling me less politics is economics. And economics is politics. And I would say, no. I believe politics is leadership, and leadership is politics. And now he's 80-some, and he's starting to come around to my thinking. Maybe you got a point, because economics haven't solved our thing. But he used to turn redder than that jacket as well, and his jugular vein would stick out, and he'd almost shake me so angry, because I was the chair of his riding association. He'd be furious and spitting, almost mad at me. And I would just sit there, well, I know I'm right. And on we go. But
is servant leadership also knowing you're right?
Maybe. Or knowing you're wrong. Probably knowing you're humble. Probably on the contrary. Maz was pretty humble. He's implemented a lot of the Canadian economic framework. Then Paul Martin came in and implemented it. And he was a knight in shining armor. So Paul Martin took the credit for Maz Mikulski's hard work with the GST and free trade agreement. So Maz did a whole bunch of the hard, dirty work in the trenches. Everybody hated Mulroney and Maz, but Paul Martin just let it go to work. He didn't do a thing. He didn't touch what they would do. And so no one recognizes Maz for what he did to help turn the economy around. And he didn't want the recognition. He would sit there and think, well, isn't that nice? They actually implemented all the things that I brought in. And he doesn't agree now with free trade in the long run. He realized he made a mistake. But that's where Maz was. Super humble. Used car salesman, grade 9 education in Vegreville. He became a pretty powerful man. Stevie Cameron, the biggest critic of politicians and the greatest journalist of politicians in Canada, loves Don Mazankowski. She went through the Hansard. He never raised his voice, never swore. He was always gentlemanly and respectful to other people. If Stevie Cameron likes Maz, then he must have something going for him, because he seems to hate the rest of us. Other servant leaders, other people you can think of.
From history, as we know here in Alberta, the group of ladies who became known as the Group of Five, and were very much involved in what became known as the person's case, where women became known as people or persons. And one of those group was Nellie McCauley. And I remember one of her quotations, I hope I have it right, and she said, "Never apologize, never explain, get the job done and let them howl."
Can I raise another issue that comes out of this as well, and which I was wondering about as you were talking about Mother Teresa, and I'd really be interested in your thinking and maybe the thinking of others about it. The famous five are famous within a particular layer of the society. I could lead you, I could take you to another part of the society where they are infamous because they were central to eugenics. So if we go out to the Ukrainian community, where you had people who were peasants from Ukraine who came here, Romania, and women who never learned the language, their husbands learned the language a little bit at the feed mill, and when they dropped off wheat. But if you go out there, where it is really the ideology that pushed these remarkable women into getting the vote and being able to serve politically, that had as its shadow side a particular notion of what it meant to be a woman, and what it meant to be a Canadian, and what it meant to be a proper Canadian. And Ukrainian women who didn't know how to speak and who thought working in the garden and farming was a good thing weren't part of that picture. So, what do you think? about how we think about the gifts of servant leaders and the limitations that most human beings have more than one thing going on within them. I thought of this issue earlier when you were speaking so lovely about Mother Teresa and her community, and I have enormous regard for this. But of course, she had an extraordinary critic, Christopher Hitchens, who sees only another side of this, who sees only another ideological side of this. So there's a sense in which I guess I could frame the question: when one thinks of servant leaders and of the gift that they bring to others, how do we think about the ideological world, which is also part often out of which they lived? And how do we have a kind of balanced way of engaging that? Some of this has come up around Mr. Mandela, because he was a communist and what have you. But I love Mel Rooney on this, whatever you might say about it. I mean, Mel Rooney was amazing when he spoke to the American president, Reagan. He said, look, Ronnie, you and I'd be communists too if we'd been in prison for 26 years and in this situation. I mean, that was remarkable to hear Mel Rooney had that kind of sense. So that is an example of someone who on the one hand can understand the ideological matters, but does not collapse the vocation of the person into that ideology. Maybe that's what I'm after. What do you make of it?
It's you're, I think you're bang on that. Mulroney is an example. He was a strong Prime Minister for our environment with Tom McMillan and his leadership team, and he had Lucien Bouchard as probably the strongest ever Minister of Environment that we've ever had until he ticked off Lucien Bouchard, and then he went and created the Bloc Québécois, then he created the Reform Party, and he ended up creating lots of parties out of one. But you're bang on. It's and part of what he writes about here, good old Robert Greenleaf, is if you were to undress a leader, you know, what was their ideology? How do you, were they really a prophet or not? Like, how do you define that? And I've heard the criticism of the Teresa, and all my heroes have critics. You know, it's so I always see the but other people have a better answer than I do. Yeah.
Yeah. So I was listening to your list of influencers in your life.
Yeah.
It seems to me that the common quality that they exhibited was the hope that by investing in you was that you would be better. They were not doing it so that something would reflect back on them.
Mm-hmm.
There's a quality of sacrifice there that ignores the person who's making the sacrifice.
Yeah.
And, of course, you can't speak for Mother Teresa, but we've read what she said. She could probably give a rip about what anyone thinks about what she was doing, save the people she was doing it for.
Mm-hmm.
And she became a leader because others noticed the difference that she was making. She did not seek to be a leader. She sought to be a servant. And because she did this so selflessly, others saw that quality and gathered around her so that she could start a movement. But again, her desire was not to start a movement, it was simply to help people that others had cast off. And, you know, your piano teacher was helping you recover and move forward.
Mm-hmm.
She was not seeking accolades or fame or fortune. She was giving of herself so that another might move forward, which is what the role of a servant is.
Mm-hmm.
But the quality there is phenomenal.
Okay, and so on David's question and your feedback, you just pretty well paraphrased Mr. Greenleaf himself. So I'm going to read just a couple of paragraphs because this is really, it's almost the same what you said. In fact, did you read this morning before he came? The servant leader is servant first. It begins with the natural feeling that one wants to serve. To serve first. Then conscious choice brings one to aspire to lead. That person is sharply different from one who is leader first, perhaps because of the need to assuage an unusual power drive or acquire material possessions. The leader first and the servant first are two extreme types. Between them are shadings and blends that are part of the infinite variety of human nature. The difference manifests itself in the care taken by the servant first to make sure that other people's highest priority needs are being served, is what you just talked about. The best test and difficult to administer is, do those served grow as persons? Do they, while being served, become healthier, wiser, freer, more autonomous, more likely themselves to become servants? And what is the effect on the least privileged in society? Will they benefit or at least not be further deprived?
That's great.
Mm-hmm. And you can just Google Greenleaf. That's how it is.
Where does it come from? How is it that a human being has that sort of stance? Where does it come from?
I'm pretty naive, but I think we're born with it, and then we lose it as society and the world mixes us up. I think it's like your grandmother. She was born with it and hung onto it for, you know, 90 years or 100 years, and I think we lose it. So I think it's part of who we are as human beings, being human. And that somehow, and I've had all kinds of temptation in this world to do, you know, radical things, but somehow it's just there inside of us. It's good. I'm an optimist. I'm maybe an idealist or whatever you call it, but I believe it's there, and then we just lose that.
Could we
ask
a little exploration of where you think it comes from?
Yeah. My answer is I don't know. Somebody better know. Darn if I know. Yeah. So I'm going to get another quote here from Lao Tzu, wrote about servant leadership in the 5th century BC. The highest type of ruler is one of whose existence the people are barely aware. The sage is self-efficacy and scanty of words. When his task is accomplished and things have been completed, all the people say, we ourselves have achieved it. So, invisible.
And Lao Tzu was talking about the Yellow Emperor and the whole notion that the country was at peace because everybody knew there was an emperor, but they didn't know his name. But they knew that everything was tranquil because of this person. And so when they saw smoke rising over the hill, they knew there were other people living over there, but they themselves had no real desire to go there because they were quite content with being where they were and in engaging what was at hand. Boy, it's a far cry from our world.
It's a far, far cry from it. I've got a little reading here.
Good old Lao Tzu.
Yeah. Do you want to find a black piece of little ribbon in there? And go, it's just three verses or four verses, Mark 10, 42 to 45. It's in red typing there. And nice and loud for this gang. I got bad hearing.
Jesus called them.
Why don't you stand up and read it with your cathedral voice?
All right.
Jesus called them together and said, "You know that those who are regarded as rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them, and their high officials exercise authority over them. Not so with you. Instead, whoever wants to become great among you must be your servant. And whoever wants to be first must be a slave of all. For even the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve and to give his life as a ransom for many."
So that sort of helps me define, I guess, a bit of what I believe is real servant leadership. And I envision Jesus washing the disciples' feet. And I've had my feet washed by a few people in my life, and it's a act of humility, an act of servitude, and I'm sort of a doubting Thomas United Church kind of guy, but if you know what he says, for even the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve, and give his life as a ransom for many, and get nailed to a cross. That's pretty humble. That's I think that's what God put in us, and there's similar stories in the Quran and in the Hindu and Tibetan Buddhist scriptures. You know, there's lots of great stories of humility and service. The world's full of them. The religions are full of them. And I see that very clearly. And that shapes sort of my understanding of servant leadership. It also highlights my hypocrisy, again, because I'm self-serving and not serving others before self, not giving my life as a ransom for other people. In the future, Greenleaf has a couple more things that I think, because I want to sort of finish, or we can keep talking here for a while. We go to what time, till 10?
Yeah.
Here's the future as he sees it. The future society may be just as mediocre as this one. It may be worse. And no amount of restructuring or changing the system or tearing it down in the hope that something better will grow will change this. There may be a better system than the one we have now. It's hard to know. But whatever it is, if the people to lead it well are not there, a better system will not produce a better society. All of this rests on the assumption that the only way to change society, or just to make it go, is to produce people, enough people, who will change it or make it go. The urgent problems of our day, the disproportion to venture into immoral and senseless wars, destruction of the environment, poverty, alienation, discrimination, overpopulation, are here because of human failures, individual failures, one person at a time, one action at a time, failures. And servant leadership is one way to address this. In the context of that one, I believe it was a bunch of Pharisees and teachers of the law and Sadducees trying to climb over each other to get to the top. I think he was probably just trying to get the message that
his own disciples are trying to.
Yeah.
Certainly an irony.
You've referred to yourself several times as being a hypocrite.
Oh, for sure.
I think we're all mixed bags. And because we're all reflecting two things simultaneously, potentially, call it natural law or the image of God within us, we're also broken. And so as we go through life, the brokenness is always struggling with the original image that was there. And I agree with you, David, that what Jesus is doing is trying to reorient us, which means turning everything upside down. Because when we think of God, we, in our flesh, we think of power and this kind of massive force out there that can rule everything. But when you look at what God himself did, as a Christian, I always think of the incarnation, which is a kenotic event, an emptying out. And Paul says, you know, he was the express image of the invisible God. What is God really telling us about himself, and how should we be reflecting that as bearers of his image? He's the ultimate parent in that he produces creativity and pours himself to an emptying degree within it. Now, if that's not a servant, I don't know what it is. And so if Christ embodies that in a way that we can really get God for the first time by seeing him visibly, physically acted out, it's not one who comes in as this powerful being that we often conceive of God and strive to achieve in our brokenness. Well, that's how you win. You become powerful like God. And I think you're right, David, is Jesus is turning that upside down and said, you really want power? Be like God. Empty it all out and start serving one another, because that's really what he does all the time.
If you really want the divine energy.
Yeah.
If you really want force, believe in Jesus. Believe in
God, because it is pursuing me first, but in the process, what will happen is you'll stop that nonsense. You'll get right, which means stop making it all about you.
And you'll discover that your only being is in communion. You don't exist as an individual.
Because we're all mixed eggs.
Yeah, you're right. We're broken, as you said. One of the ways that that's expressed that I like very much is the way Henry Nouwen, some of you are familiar with his work, he talks about the wounded healer. We heal other people, but only through our own wounds. And we have to be conscious of them all the time.
One of the things that in healing others too, I was thinking about what you're saying about Mother Teresa, and she went in and out and gathered the dying and brought them in, or whatever people did. And I take a look around cameras, and when we're talking about being servants and whatnot, I look, it's not as visible. Like, she knew exactly who she had to go and get. In cameras, who do you, like, I know it's people that you encountered, but I'm sure that there's probably a lot of people within cameras that need servants to help them, but they're invisible. They're not as visible as the people that Mother Teresa was after. And I guess that's my dilemma when I think about it. How do we find the people in cameras that are as broken as the people that Mother Teresa brought into her shelter without just kind of closing, you know, like people we are surrounded with here, none of us are really that broken. But how do we find and how do we reach out? I know we have to, you know, do it to whoever we encounter, but to me that's a dilemma. Like, I don't see them as she would see the dying.
Right. And I believe that God puts people in our lives for a reason as we go along. And if I walk downtown today, there'll probably be, you know, one of the youth from the open door or some lonely person or some lonely senior in the grocery store at the co-op. It takes 2 hours to buy your groceries because they want to visit. And there's just small little things. It's not to be drastic. It doesn't need to be as drastic as Obima. You know, there's less drastic. There's a lot of loneliness on campus here. We've got 500 students in res, and we're overwhelmed with how lonely they are. And it's just taking time and being sensitive to, you know, have a servant heart and look at people. Like, we look at ourselves as broken and see that other people are all equally broken. And I believe that those people the God puts the ones in our lives that we need to help out, I guess. That's what. So it's the more, if we can, I guess I always figure if I can see people through the eyes of God, then maybe they need more than it appears they need. And we all do. We're all acting, and we all need to be more human. But that it's around. But you're right. This is this particular group is, you know, this is an on the ball group. Holy cow! I can't keep up.
Last time, do you apply this analogy or this admonition to the Olympics? Well, the ultimate goal is to be first.
Oh, I'm blamed because I've had Becky Scott, Olympic gold medalist, and I've got Alex Harvey. I was in Quebec for 7 years coaching. He's our next Olympic gold medalist. Unless he falls down, he'll be having Olympic medals 2 weeks from now. And all I can do is what Gibber said to me. Remember, you're not coaching cross-country skiing. You're coaching people who cross-country ski. So if Becky Scott's a good person, Alex Harvey's a good person, that's the investment. I don't care about the medals. I hope we finish last if he's a good person.
Not to be last.
No. But it's a challenge because all these coaches want to coach Alex Harvey. They want to coach young British guy I've got because he's now an up-and-coming superstar. And so I say, okay, I'll stand back. If you want to become the coach and get your name on the newspaper, that's fine with me. But it's developing people. The sport is hopeless. I hate the Olympics. I despise the Olympic movement, Coca-Cola, the corporate sponsorship. Putin and I are on opposite sides of the coin when it comes to the corruption and bribery. And
no, not really.
Really, yeah. We're having quite a go at it. So I'm actually headed to Chechnya on the way to Russia. And then Chechnya afterwards as well with Human Rights Watch and Amnesty International. But those are more important things than the Olympics by far. There's no comparison. So I guess one of the mistakes I see of servant leadership, if there is one, sometimes people do too much stuff for other people. It doesn't serve them at all. So I see some parents that are helicopter parents do too much for their kids, or people try to do things for people, but by doing that, you're doing them a disservice. So sometimes servant leadership needs to be tough love. Sometimes it needs to be, you know, to serve someone really, you have to not, you know, do everything for them. You know, you can support them, but that's how it goes. Back to our earlier discussions, well, Billy Graham, Mother Teresa, you read their journals and the pain and suffering and temptation and the horrible thinking they've gone and written down. But, you know, the higher they've been admonished in the world, the more they've suffered and the more they've written some horrific human, you know, dark, black, horrible stuff of their self-thoughts or what they struggled with. And I think, I can't believe Billy Graham would write this, or I can't believe Mother Teresa would write this stuff. You know, it doesn't make sense. How could they be such phenomenal servants and then struggle in the depths of despair? It's worse than Job, the stuff they've written. I think, wow, that's odd. But it's real. Like they've been honest. Oh my gosh.
It says something about the connection between brokenness and service.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I've sometimes thought that the greatest suffering in our society, this is just a kind of an abstract reflection, is in Sherwood Park, not on 96th Street.
Mm-hmm.
That the isolation and the alienation in the context of people who are upper middle class and middle class is far greater than it is among the poor. I don't know if I'm right or not about that, but it's trying to get at a particular kind of point. But part of the problem, I think, that you're really flagging is also a political, institutional, and social policy issue. We have, out of our concerns in liberal democratic societies, and out of our sense of a concern for others who have struggles in their life, we have developed professions, we have developed, and one of the tragedies of that, I mean, I'm not saying it's not a good thing to do, I think this is a problem for us, is that we have depersonalized, we've created institutional distance between ourselves and particularly the struggles of those who are poor or disinherited. Michael Ignatieff writes his extraordinary book, The Needs of Strangers, in which he analyzed this issue. I think, you know, on my list of the 100 books everybody ought to read. But it's a huge challenge for us. So when you look at cameras, there are institutions and there are policies in place which mean that you may be reasonably well fed, but your soul is starving. So it's a big problem for us. But the other part of it is seeing the people that you know and one's own self, and recognizing, being present enough to recognize the sorrow, the alienation, the loneliness, the struggle. That if Mother Teresa teaches us anything, she teaches us it's in every human heart. Thanks so much, Les.
It was terrific.
We really hope you don't win any medals over there, because we don't.